Darkness falls across the land.
The midnight hour is close at hand.
Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize y'all's neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. The foulest stench is in the air.
The grisly of 40,000 years are closing
and
in
grisly
to seal
your
every
tomb are closing in to seal your doom.
Your body starts to shiver,
and though you fight
no
to
mere
stay alive,
can resist
your body starts to shiver,
the
for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
Hello, Kaiju campers, and welcome to October here at Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. That was, of course, Vincent Price's iconically blood-curdling monologue at the end of Michael Jackson's 1983 classic tune, the music video of which was directed by John Landis. Monster kids know him well. Just from the Bad Boy Boogie Blues Brothers, but An American Werewolf in London, of course, a classic of the genre. With Magic and Monsters, we are presenting a not-so-classic of the genre, and yet perfect for this autumnal spooky season. The Watcher in the Woods from 1980 from Walt Disney Studios. Me and Patrick Kozicki of Gaze to the D, an unofficial Disney podcast, break down the behind-the-scenes of the film, the production, and explore the reason why the film is most well-known today, or, ironically, its obscurity. New copies of this movie are no longer printed on physical media, Blu-ray, DVD. Such things can only be found online, on secondhand websites. The film is not streaming on Disney Plus, and despite all that, it retains its cult classic status as the scariest Disney movie of all time. Well, it's certainly spooky, and as a ghost story, perfect again for this time of year. Patrick and I talk about all of our other favorite ghost stories and ghost movies, and other classic horror cinema of the late 70s, early 80s. So we hope you enjoy this special conversation. And I, Vincent, hope you enjoy Camp Kaiju. And stay tuned for just next week. Me and Matt Levine will be back at you with our regular programming when we discuss 1925's The Phantom of the Opera. More classic monsters, more ghosts, and more great in-depth discussion. This time we're being joined by special guest film critic Paul McGuire Grimes. It's going to be a good conversation. We've already recorded it and look forward to sharing it with you. So thank you all for listening, and until next time, stay campy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is Vincent from the Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast.
And this is Patrick from Gaze Do the D Podcast, and we are here for another crossover episode of Magic and Monsters, where we explore the wonderful world of creature features.
And on this installment, we are diving into the supernatural, going through the woods. We're going to be watching for things. We're going to go on that hike through 1980s, The Watcher in the Woods, a cult classic from Disney.
So grab onto your popcorn and hold tight to your walking sticks, and away we go.
To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
Okay, here we are. Magic and Monsters, the fourth episode.
Four episodes. All right. All right. We're making some progress here. We're quarterly installments now, I think.
So we made it second year with Magic and Monsters, and we got some things coming up. You're going to announce the next episode at some point.
Yeah. I'm very excited about it, too. It'll be a fun one.
I don't know what that is, listeners. So stick around to the end of this episode. And we'll see what Patrick has up for us next. Maybe the Shaggy DA.
No one wants that. I promise you. Not one person is voting for that.
Well, how are you, Patrick?
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. Thanks for asking. You know, I am so grateful right now here in Minnesota. The heat has broken, at least for now. It is delightful. 70 degrees out today. We have our windows open. It's not raining for the first time in roughly 87 years. I'm well. This is my power season, the fall. When the fall hits, I feel a lot better about life. I don't know.
Totally. Why. Yeah, it is August, but the windows are open, and it does feel autumnal out there. Pumpkin spice is creeping into the coffee shops.
Oh, it's already hit my kitchen as well. I've got some pumpkin spice cold foam for my coffees. I'm into it. I'm basic, and I'm okay with it.
I love it.
Thanks. How are you? What's going on?
I went back to work this week. Folks listening, I'm a teacher at a high school in Minneapolis, and students don't come back till September after Labor Day, but teachers are back.
Listen, I applaud you for the work that you do. We love our teachers, so thanks for doing that. I appreciate that. my work is nothing compared to the impact that you are making in reality.
Well, thank you. We all do our part, but thank you.
We try anyways.
We host a podcast, and, you know, I do want to, like, just acknowledge that as a podcaster, I can get lost in the minutiae of editing and likes and clicks and this and that. And sometimes I get a little disillusioned, like the world is burning and we're just talking about Disney and monster movies.
Yeah.
But I have listeners who reach out to me on Camp Kaiju and say, I appreciate listening to you and my co-host Matt and Patrick because they look forward to what we bring. And it brings them a little joy. And I'm like, okay, I can get behind that. So to all you listening, I hope this episode brings you joy. I certainly hope it doesn't cause you pain. We'll see.
Fair. That's the goal, to not cause any pain. I like that. Oh, I love that. What a great way to start the episode, because this movie that we're about to talk about is anything but straightforward and joyful. I feel like it's the opposite of that. But yeah, like, full disclosure, Vincent, you and I were talking just sort of about life before we started recording, and, you know, things are a little dark right now every once in a while, and that's the way life can be. So that's great to hear that people are reaching out and expressing that they find some glimmer of joy and hope in just forgetting for a little bit, for like an hour and a half once a week or so. And I have to say, it also brings me joy to do these episodes because I get to sort of dive into topics that I love and hang out with the friends that I love. So right back at you, everybody. We love doing it too.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. So let's talk about The Watcher in the Woods.
Yes.
And listeners, what we're going to do here is we're going to go through the production history of the film, both from like the Disney perspective, what was happening in the late 70s, early 80s with Disney and maybe their live action content. We're going to talk about the cast and crew a little bit of this film. We have a quiz, the continuation of the quiz with me and Patrick. And I think where our score stands right now is...
Uh-oh, I don't want to know.
Well, for all intents and purposes, it's tied. But I have the point half.
Perfect.
The half a point edge on you. So I have 6.5 to your 6. So Watcher in the Woods is honestly a tiebreaker episode. It's very exciting. It's like, you know, Monday Night Football here.
It's very suspenseful. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Okay. Watcher in the Woods. Why?
Yes.
Why Watcher in the Woods? Well,
great question.
So a mutual listener of Gaze Do the D and Camp Kaiju, Jeff, we want to thank you for lending us your Blu-ray edition of The Watcher in the Woods, which is currently out of print. Disney no longer prints physical media of The Watcher in the Woods, nor do they stream it on their Disney Plus platform. Of course, I think you could find the movie if you dig deep enough in the internet, but this movie is getting harder to find each year. And yet I heard that it has been called the scariest Disney movie of all time. So I immediately wanted to seek it out and bring it to this podcast. Perfect fit.
Yeah, you would think. One would think. Absolutely. Yeah, but much like Karen in the movie and the book, it has been disappeared fully from planet Earth, The Watcher in the Woods.
Maybe if we go to Jupiter, it's out there.
Who can say?
Star.
Yeah. It's stuck in the space-time limbo right now somewhere out there.
What is your experience with this movie?
My personal experience? Okay, well, here's a fun fact. You and I watched it together at the very same time. I had seen it many moons ago because it came out in 1980, but it was one of those movies that was on television every once in a while in like the 90s during the day. Like if you're homesick from school, this actually may have been on television here and there for some reason. So I remembered having seen it, but watching it with you, apparently I didn't remember anything about the movie because I was shocked at every turn of the movie of like, oh, this story, I do not remember this character or this storyline or this weird plot twist or lack thereof a plot twist. Or yeah, it was just watching it through fresh adult eyes was definitely a trip. I hesitate to sort of say, I don't actually mean this, but I kind of understand why Disney doesn't necessarily promote this movie anymore, because it's not necessarily a well-made movie, if I'm being very honest with you, like just in my initial thoughts. It's definitely, I can appreciate the movie from the perspective of when they made it. It was probably a little bit more cutting edge and a little bit more exciting than it is in today's standard. So you have to like watch movies like these with the perspective of somebody watching it in 1980 and going, oh, okay, maybe in 1980 this was a lot better than it is today. Although it didn't get reviews in 1980, well, good reviews in 1980 either. So
yeah, so maybe it just like wasn't a good movie then, but I'm not saying it's not a good movie now. I'll talk more about that later, but
sure.
You bring up that time period. You're watching this movie in the theaters in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We're just coming out of the 70s, but like, I am new to this time period in Disney's live action history.
Sure.
So how does this compare to, and I'm just throwing out other movies I'm aware of, like The Race to Witch Mountain or The Escape, whichever ones were out in the 70s, you know?
Sure. Yeah. So if you look at, if you take the historical lens, like specifically from Disney, so at this time period, this is when Disney was, I don't want to use the word flailing, but they were definitely in a very experimental stage of their history. The animation movement had died down a little bit. They still had their classics, and they were still pumping out a couple of movies every year or so, animation-wise. And they were getting kids in the Disney fold with that. They never really had a problem there. They also, once they started making live-action comedies, they also had sort of an adult base, right? Think about the Shaggy Dog, the 1950s and 60s, Herbie, all those crazy, wacky films. They realized at this time that they weren't really getting those late teens and 20s audiences in the fold, so they weren't really going to see the cartoons, and they weren't really going to see these more adult comedies. They weren't really hitting with teens. And at this time, I think you'll talk about this a little bit more as well, there was sort of a boom in sci-fi and horror movies that Disney just wasn't playing in they weren't in the game necessarily. So they were scrambling to figure out how to get that age group, how to sort of bring the sci-fi, the horror fans, who were mostly teens and people in their 20s, early 30s, into the movie theaters. This also was the early days of then, if you remember, Touchstone was in the early 80s, started to hit the scenes, which was a subset of Disney. This was the movie company that they decided to put all of their movies they didn't know what to do with under the Disney umbrella. They put them under the umbrella of Touchstone. Think the movie Splash or Risky Business, all those kind of movies. Anything with Bette Midler in it would be under Touchstone.
Hmm.
This movie, however, came out right before Touchstone hit. This was them going, we need to figure out, a way to get these teens and early 20s audiences in, and we want to dabble into something that isn't so childish as well and not a comedy. So we get a movie like Watcher in the Woods. The book had come out a couple of years previously. They grabbed onto it because it was right in that age range of even where the book was selling to, you know, late teens, early 20s audiences. And they figured this might be a movie we want to make. There was talk about this being their version of The Exorcist, strangely. Which,
well, I mean,
sure.
Sure. If, okay. If Disney were to make The Exorcist.
Yeah.
This would be it, I guess.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. But again, this was incredibly experimental for Disney. And so I think that's sort of why we get a little bit, in my opinion, of a muddled movie. Because this is their first time really delving into something that they were trying to make scary. Whereas movies like Something Wicked This Way Comes, Race to Witch Mountain, or Escape to Witch Mountain, they were a little bit more of the Disney formula with a little bit of a hypersensitive supernatural element to them, but they weren't going for necessarily a horror movie. This was their attempt at making a Disney horror movie. And so you can see that this is their very first and probably last attempt at making a Disney horror movie, you could argue. So yeah.
Right. A horror movie with that takes itself very seriously.
It does. Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting because I think you can make a, quote, Disney horror movie,
mm-hmm.
but you really, I think, have to be very intentional, maybe about the choices you're making in terms of direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because how my brain works, Disney and horror do not mix. Like, Disney,
sure. Yeah.
Disney, if you're not going to do violence or other suggestive content, well, okay, but then how do you make it work? And obviously horror does exist in the children's world, but there's a way to do it. And so I agree with you, it's a little muddled, the finished product. And there was conflict between the producers and the director and
absolutely
and whatnot on that tone that we're talking about.
And I think they were held back a little bit. Had this come out 4 years later, when Touchstone was a thing, I think it would have been a better movie. I think they were held back by keeping it under the Disney banner because they hold the word and the title Disney so precious, and they can't offend too many people, that I think they held themselves back by that. I fully believe if they had utilized the Touchstone Pictures realm to make this movie, they would have leaned more into the horror genre of it.
That fascinates me, the fact that you could think that exactly what you said, like this movie just came out 1 year too early.
I think so, yeah.
It's just like, oh, but maybe, I don't know, whoever's in charge learns lessons from what they did with Watcher in the Woods.
Absolutely. I have to believe that they definitely took this as a blueprint for what they could do, and they learned from their mistakes, because Touchstone then became a juggernaut. Like, they were the biggest movie company in the late 80s and 90s. And so they learned a ton from this movie, for sure.
A film like Arachnophobia comes to mind. That's a
absolutely
Touchstone horror film that works as like a family fright fest. Like, it's like that. I think that's a brilliant movie, honestly.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and go back and listen to your episode of Arachnophobia on Camp Kaiju. It's a great episode. Yeah.
Do you ever find it surprising when you meet somebody who doesn't like horror movies?
That's a great question. I don't know if surprising is, but I
do
feel
I'm being a little facetious, but
yeah, no, but I do feel like, oh, you don't quite get me then. If you don't, if I can't watch a horror movie with you, then yeah, we might be limited in our conversations.
yeah, because like I'm like we're the same mind. Like we love horror movies and the macabre and. You know, and but like looking at us, you never know. We look straight laced and, you know.
yeah.
But, you know, come Halloween,
I know.
We're monsters. So, yeah, when I meet somebody who's like, oh, I don't watch horror movies, I'm just like, oh, I guess I'm in my own little bubble here. All right.
It's true. It's true. But yeah, it's like when people are like, I don't like roller coasters, which is fine. It's like, oh, okay. Well, if we go to a theme park together, there's very little we can do together if you don't like roller coasters.
I'm not a roller coaster person.
That's fair. Yeah. So I know not to go there with you.
Well, you know, you'll find me at all the shows.
That's right. Absolutely. And same though. Amazing. Amazing.
I don't want to get too off top. No. We'll continue. I was just gonna say, I was always nervous but interested in writing. Is it Space Mountain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never got on it.
Stay away from it if you don't like roller coasters. Space Mountain is no joke, my friend.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for telling me.
I can't recommend it if you don't like roller coasters.
Okay.
There you go.
Love horror movies. I'm still a scaredy cat, but you know.
Yeah, that's fair.
We contain multitudes.
We sure do. We sure do.
All right.
As did the 70s and 80s with their sci-fi and horror genres.
Yeah, great segue there. So thanks. We talked about the Disney context of Watcher in the Woods.
Yeah.
I was digging into the horror context of this time period, and it didn't take me long to figure out or to obviously realize, oh, there are some big titles that I love to talk about. But also some trends started to emerge, which I found interesting related to The Watcher in the Woods. So first off, in my estimation, I'm watching Watcher in the Woods. It's not a small project from Disney. It's something they want to push as a big movie, big release. At this time in cinema, let me back up. In movie making, in the late 70s, you had a number of high concept movies being made, meaning these movies take place on the ocean with a giant shark. Or in space with a bunch of aliens fighting a galactic battle.
Yes.
Before this time period, these movies weren't made on an A level. They were relegated to cheapy B movies. But folks like, you know, Spielberg, Lucas, and the sort ushered in the era of the blockbuster. So Watcher in the Woods started filming in August 1979. In the late 70s, you had Star Wars, obviously, in 77. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. These are, especially Close Encounters, they're also deep movies. They're not just popcorn fare. And I think Watcher in the Woods kind of wants to live in that world with the high concept movies.
I agree, yeah.
But there's also a lot of horror films at this time period. And the popular ones that I include are Carrie from 1976, Halloween 1978, The Amityville Horror 1979. And again, these are also catering to the teen demographic. So if Disney's wanting to get a slice of that pie, well, I mean, this has been the case since movies have been made. Teenagers love horror movies. It's just something about the genre.
That's true.
In 1980, when Watcher in the Woods had its official premiere, Friday the 13th was released.
That's right, yeah.
And then three movies that I included because they are also ghost movies. The Fog by John Carpenter, The Shining, and The Changeling. And so I'm just thinking about other ghost movies that were released at the same time.
Yeah.
And was there something about ghosts and the supernatural specifically in the culture at that time? I don't know.
Hard to know. Yeah. I have kind of a theory around trends when it comes to horror and sci-fi, because those go fairly hand in hand together. They're not exactly the same thing, but it always seems to me that after like something very big culturally, politically happens, we then get a boom of horror movies or sci-fi movies. So if you think about it, like Nixon was a big thing happening around this time, and Vietnam was just ending at this time, and so we're still getting out of that. And so, I mean, this is honestly just me hypothesizing, but this also happened sort of after World War II as well. We got a lot of interesting horror movies happening around that time as well. And so I wonder if that's a sort of a cultural thing where people were just looking for movies that had a very clear good guy and bad guy. You know what I mean? Where there wasn't any questions about it. It was just sort of like, this is good, this is bad, but we're not going to try to get too political or too superhero-y or too, you know, evangelist about it. We're just going to give you something that's entertaining with a very clear good guy, bad guy, with usually the good guy winning in the end kind of a movie. So I don't know. Mm. That's just a theory I have. I don't know if it sticks or not, but something that I've been thinking about.
My armchair theory that you're prompting me on to think about is, you know, late 70s, it's post-Watergate, you know, there's an election in the fall of 1980 with Reagan coming in, and people were just disillusioned with politics and the economy was terrible. So I've read in my history books. So maybe coincidentally, maybe not, it's coinciding with the rise of popular high concept stories. Is this indicative of a need to escape and escapism, which I fully dived into at like during COVID, for instance. I just wanted popcorn fare. I just want to shut my brain off, you know, for a couple hours.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe there's something to that. Yeah.
And just sort of like the emotion that these movies evoke from you, just like psychically a little bit. You know what I mean? Like when you go to the movies, these are the movies that you're going to go see to sort of have an adrenaline rush a little bit, or like a cerebral rush as well, that is different than sitting and like stewing in sorrow or, you know, feeling angsty. These definitely have the very opposite effect of that, you know? So maybe there's something there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a really interesting time culturally in the United States, and I think a really rich time in cinema at this era. Because this is when all the classics are established for, like, the stuff we grew up on and love. I mean, I'd still love to talk about Friday the 13th on Camp Kaiju at some point, if you want to come on.
Oh, I will. You know me. I will absolutely on for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a cinematic cultural shift, too, this time, in you know, the late 70s, early 80s. Like, things changed dramatically and sort of wrote the book of the movies we watch today are happening because of these movies in the late 70s.
Yeah. That's all pretty cool. I love that. I love talking about this stuff.
Yes.
The cast and crew of The Watcher in the Woods, extensive. Yeah. Patrick, I think we can, if you want, we don't have to go through all these names.
No, we don't.
And credits. But first and foremost, The Watcher in the Woods stars the Bette Davis, a Hollywood icon, legend of classic Hollywood.
She's definitely the name they brought onto this movie to get adults also to see it, this movie, because Bette Davis, around this time, this was also some of the reason why they rushed the movie. I don't want to get too off track here, but it was soon to be the 50th anniversary of her first film. And so this movie sort of coincided with that as well, like sort of sealing her in as a Hollywood legend. So this would have been the 50-year anniversary of her making movies, was The Watcher in the Woods.
Right. I see that she was born April 5th, which happens to be my birthday, although she was born in 1908. I'm not that old. She won the Oscar for Best Actress twice. She was the first person to accrue 10 Academy Award nominations for acting, and a plethora of other commendations. Yeah, so Books have been written. Movies have been made. Go watch some Bette Davis classics.
Legend.
Including Watcher in the Woods.
Watcher in the Woods.
Yeah. She may not call it a classic.
Well, she doesn't say anything these days because she's no longer with us.
Are you sure?
Bette Davis?
Yeah.
I imagine so. I guess I'm not. Now that now I'm questioning it. I'm like, she'd be quite elderly at this point, but... Now I'm like, well, maybe she is 108 years old. I don't know.
She would no. She'd be 100 and
I'm trying to do the math.
13. But... I'm trying to.
There we go.
Yeah, 113 years old. I mean, she could be.
God bless.
She's not alive, but in no. theory, people have lived that long.
Fair. Yeah. Absolutely. R.I.P. Bette Davis, you legend.
I almost got you there. The look on your face.
I was like, wait, now I'm second guessing it. Ay, ay, ay.
In the sequel, she will play the ghost.
Jeez. We have to move on immediately.
No, there's no one else in this movie worth talking about.
Well,
who, you talk about some. Are there any Disney alums in here? Anyone?
Well, there's one. Kyle Richards is in it. Gaze Through the D fans will know Kyle Richards from The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. She is a recurring cast member on that. And you would know her, Vincent. She was in the original Halloween as well. She was one of the little kids that was being babysat in that movie. But she also, I believe it was either her or her sister, or maybe both of them, made appearances or were in Escape to Witch Mountain and Return from Witch Mountain as well. So they did have a couple of Disney credits there. And she was a reoccurring character in Little House on the Prairie as well. So kind of a bigger name.
Wow.
At least in today's standards. Yeah. Yeah. And then she went on to do some of the sequels of Halloween later on, the ones that came out in the 2000s or later 2000s, Halloween Ends and Halloween Kills. She comes back and recreates her character in those movies as well.
Nice. Good for her.
Little crossover there, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Lynn Holly Johnson plays Jan Curtis. She is the lead. She is a... Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm. It's been a minute since we watched the movie, but...
Yeah.
Lynn Holly Johnson as Jan Curtis. She is the lead of this movie. She's a teenage girl who delves deeper and deeper into this mystery because... Mm-hmm. She is, in her mind, maybe like being stalked, haunted by the Bette Davis character, Mrs. Aylward. Mm-hmm. And as we find out, Lynn Holly Johnson as Jan Curtis mightily resembles Mrs. Aylward's long-lost daughter, who is believed dead. So there's like a mystery there of identity, and does Jan have a connection to the daughter? Is there something spiritual, supernatural going on? That's kind of the core mystery.
Yeah.
But Lynn Holly Johnson was nominated for a Golden Globe, not for this movie, for a movie called Ice Castles, where she plays a blind figure skater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She does indeed.
She won a Razzie for Worst Supporting Actress in Where the Boys Are in 1985.
Two very opposite ends of the spectrum there. She went from a real high to a real low. Well, I mean, those are kind of the big names in the movie. A lot of people were like, well, what about this person? So the rest of the cast, Carol Baker as the mother, David McCallum as the dad. He's more of a British actor that a lot of people may know. Benedict Taylor, Francis Cuca, I believe, is how you pronounce that name. Richard Pascoe, Ian Brennan, Catherine Levy, and Eleanor Summerfield sort of round out the cast of characters in this movie who sort of may or may not have something to do with this mystery that is unfolding within the woods. And yeah, a lot of them play red herrings in the movie. A lot of them play very specific, this is their fault people in the movie. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting cast of characters that fly in and out of the movie. And I'll be honest, I wasn't always certain who everyone was in the movie while we were watching it, because there wasn't a lot of exposition in this movie, which usually is great for me. I'm like, I don't love exposition, but I really needed it for this movie, I feel like.
Totally. Yeah, going back to the muddled nature. Who is the, like, hunky blonde farm boy that,
oh,
that
sure.
Jan befriends?
That would have been Benedict Taylor. Mike Fleming was the character's name. Mike Fleming.
Okay. Mike Fleming. He was, you know, he wasn't the brightest bulb in the box. Is that right?
That's fair to say. Yeah, he was. It was a weird character. We'll talk about it a little bit later on. In the book, it's a much more fleshed out character, but yeah. In this movie, he was just sort of. He just suddenly was there for some reason, right? Remember, we were watching. We're like, "Who is this kid? And why is he talking to the main character?"
You're right. He always kind of just showed up, and I remember thinking this was a critique I had of the film. His character and the Lynn Holly Johnson character. They were presented like they were in a boyfriend-girlfriend situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were very flirty with each other. And in any other movie, you would expect them to be in that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe because it's a Disney movie, they never actually, you know, they didn't make out or anything. And
no.
And in a horror movie from 1980... That's what you would want. That's what teens want to see.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't ever very clear what their relationship was, other than he was just there in the movie. They suddenly appeared out of nowhere and they were friends. So, okay. Great.
Yeah. The director of The Watcher in the Woods, John Huff, I'm going to say, because I knew somebody in college with that last name spelled that way. But John Huff, he was kind of a journeyman director. Some credits to his name include Sudden Terror, Twins of Evil, The Legend of Hell House, Escape to Witch Mountain, and Return from Witch Mountain. So he had worked with Disney before.
Yeah.
And clearly had worked in this genre before.
Yeah, I think he was a very specific choice for them because he had dabbled on both sides of the spectrum there.
Yeah. An uncredited director, Vincent McAvity, was more of a TV director, things like Star Trek, Perry Mason, Bonanza, but some Disney movies. Do you want to talk about those?
Sure, yeah. He was directing a lot of the weird adult comedy movies for Disney that we were talking about earlier. The Million Dollar Duck, The Strongest Man in the World, Gus, about a football-playing mule. If you want to go back and watch that movie, it's a real weird one. Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo and Herbie Goes Bananas. If you were a fan of the Herbie films, you can thank him for directing those.
I've never had the pleasure. Sorry to say.
They're wild. They're wild.
I love the titles of these old Disney movies. I'm a title guy.
Yeah, they did anything. Yeah. They did anything. I think I have to believe that they just sat in a room and created titles for a while and then were like, all right, we got to make a movie based on this title, The Million Dollar Duck. Okay, great. Let's do it.
100%.
It was like that refrigerator magnets of just words that they would throw at the refrigerator. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, there's the title.
Or they brought in their children to generate ideas.
Sure. The original AI were just kids and magnets thrown against the fridge.
Oh, my gosh. Well, this other director, Vincent McAvity.
Yeah.
He directed some of the reshoots. So Disney released this movie. They quickly pulled it from theaters because it was not doing well. And they spent a year doing some reshoots and editing. And McAvity was the director for that. I read that under union guidelines, McAvity didn't get credit because apparently for the Directors Guild, you have to meet so many hours of directing the movie to get the credit. So him just being brought on for reshoots just didn't warrant a credit.
Didn't make the cut, as you might say. I think that rule has changed since then, but that was definitely in effect back then.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of movies have, like, tons of writers, too. This movie did, too. They brought in a bunch of writers to concoct a bunch of alternate endings. Obviously, none of them are credited, either.
Yeah, some of them will never even know their names, I'm sure, because apparently, like, upwards of 20 different writers at one point were working on this movie.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about the writers who are credited?
Sure. Not a ton to talk about with them. Brian Clemens, Harry Spalding, and Rosemary Ann Sisson were the main writers that I guess got billing, at least, for this movie. Brian Clemens was more of a TV writer, so episodes here and there of many television shows in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. Harry Spalding apparently has a lot of low-budget horror sci-fi movies to his name. It makes sense that they would have brought these folks on, but they just didn't have a lot of like high-profile credits to their name. Rosemary Ann Sisson did have a little bit more Disney clout under her name. She was a renowned British screenwriter, and some of her Disney screenplays include Ride a Wild Pony, Escape from the Dark, Candleshoe, and The Black Cauldron in 1985, which was Disney's take on a horror movie for the animated audiences out there.
Music is composed by Stanley Myers. We have cinematography by Alan Hume. Lots of big-time credits. Yeah. Gulliver's Travels, Return of the Jedi, Octopussy, A View to Kill, Runaway Train, and A Fish Called Wanda.
That's right. I have to say, I would say the saving... It sounds like I hate this movie. I don't hate this movie, but I think the best thing about this movie, though, was the cinematography behind the movie. A lot of the shots were really cool, and I really appreciated that. It definitely held the movie together for me, the work that this man was doing on cinematography for The Watcher in the Woods.
I agree. There's an ethereal sense of from the movie, which I think works with its mystery and supernaturalness. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And you read the
book,
right?
I did get the book, which is also, much like the movie, out of print. And so I went on eBay and bought an old copy of the book.
How is it? Should I read it?
Actually, you know what? I have to say, it's not a groundbreaking, amazing book that everyone must read. It is a lot better than the plot of this movie, though. It is very different than the movie. Like, even all in right. so much that it's not even set. So the movie is set in England for some reason, because the book is not at all set. It's set in New Hampshire, I think.
Oh.
Instead. So,
okay. Movies
I don't.
In
yeah,
Old
I don't
Hampshire.
Know why they moved it to Europe for the movie, but they sure did. Who can say why? But the book is definitely different than the plot of the movie, even in so much as the old woman, Mrs. Aylward, played by Bette Davis in the movie, is barely in the book. Not a huge character in the book. Definitely has a huge plot point in the book, but is very rarely even mentioned in the book. So it's definitely different. And I would say there's a lot more, there's a bigger sci-fi turn in the book than the movie sort of holds on to. So I don't know why they changed it so much for the movie, because I think if they had filmed it the way the plot unfolds in the book, they would have had a much more successful movie on their hands. So I would like to have been in the room to figure out why they changed it so dramatically from the book. Who knows? Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. There's a huge kind of a twisty turn at the end that's very sci-fi heavy. So like, we have this ghost story through ostensibly for the whole movie, and then right at the end, I mean, we are going to talk about spoilers, yeah, listeners, but suddenly you get full-on science fiction with creatures and other dimensions and portals. And it was kind of a mind-blowing experience to watch this movie.
It was very out of left field. It did not build up to that at the end. You were not expecting that. Whereas the book definitely has a better burn, a slow burn into easing you into what's about to happen at the end. With this one, it was just like, what movie is this? This is a different movie than we've been watching for the past hour.
And again, I did not hate this movie, but I love the ending so much. I thought, and specifically the alternate endings, which ironically is not the theatrical version. It's not the version you saw on TV many moons ago. So it's like, what I love about this movie isn't actually technically the movie, which is
that's
so
fair,
ironic.
That's fair. I'm with you 100%. Ay, ay, ay.
Do you want to go through the synopsis?
Sure.
At all?
So we have this American family, these two parents, Helen and Paul Curtis, and then their two daughters, Jan and Ellie. They're moving into a manor in rural England. Mrs. Aylward is the owner of this residence, who now lives sort of in this guest house right next door to it. She notices that Jan, after they have purchased this house, Jan bears a striking resemblance to her daughter, Karen, who has disappeared inside an abandoned chapel in the woods 30 years earlier. That is not a plot point in the book at all. But Karen actually is missing. It has been missing for a long time, but there's none of this chapel storm seance stuff makes it into the book at all. So they made all of that up for the
movie. Whoa.
Interestingly enough. Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, Jan senses something unusual about the property almost immediately and begins to see strange blue lights in the woods, as well as triangles and glowing objects. On one occasion, she sees the apparition of a blindfolded girl in a mirror in front of her. I thought that was an effectively scary moment.
Yeah, the moments that they did pull out horror-wise, I thought they did a good job of, I have to say.
There's something creepy about mirrors when one shows up in a horror movie, and there's something creepy about blindfolded girls in mirrors.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, 100%. And also, wasn't there a moment where she looked in the mirror and didn't see her own reflection, which was kind of creepy as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Vampire? We didn't know what was going on.
I still don't, I think.
Still don't. Good point. Shortly after the family settles in, Ellie, the younger sister, goes to buy a puppy. This was also out of left field. She names the dog Nurak.
Nurak.
Nurak?
She says it, yeah.
Nurak? Nurak. N-E-R-A-K. And you're like, what the hell is Nurak? Well, we're going to tell you. Because then Jan sees the name Nurak reflected. Cool, because Ellie wrote the name Nurak, maybe to say, like, how do you spell this? She wrote it out. And then Jan sees the reflection of the name, and it's Karen spelled backwards. So then Jan is told about the mystery of Mrs. Aylward's missing daughter by Mike, the teenage son of a local woman named Mary. Mike Fleming is the archetypal handsome but dumb farm boy who fills in a lot of expo for us. He fills Jan in on the local goings-ons. Yeah. So yeah, Nurak.
So clever. So clever. Okay, so we have this dog, Nurak, Karen spelled backwards. We cut to a scene where the dog, the puppy, runs into the woods, and Ellie chases after him. Jan realizes that her sister disappeared from the yard. She goes looking for her into the woods, and eventually locating her at this pond, which is also in the woods. In the water, she sees a blue circle of light and is blinded by a flash, causing her to fall into the water, where she nearly drowns. But then we get Mrs. Aylward saving her life. It looks like we have this sort of suspenseful scene, right, where she takes this walking stick and it looks like maybe she's pushing her into the water and trying to drown her from the audience's point of view, but then you realize that she's actually trying to get her to hold on to the stick and pull her out of it. So she gets her out of the water, brings her and Ellie to her home, and she sort of fully goes into what her recollection is the night that her daughter has disappeared fully, seemingly, from Earth. They have no idea where she is.
Right. Later, Mike discovers that his mother, Mary, was with Karen when she disappeared. Karen is the name of Mrs. Aylward's lost daughter. So, Karen, Nurak, it's all coming together. So, Mike discovers that his mom was with Karen when Karen disappeared. But his mom is evading Mike's questions. It's very like, okay, the elder townspeople have this shared secret. Actually, you know, it reminds me of A Nightmare on Elm Street, when all the adults on the block... Sure. They have this terrible
there's
secret,
a cover-up happening.
And the kids are like, yeah, what happened? And nobody wants to talk about it. Yep. Meanwhile, Jan attempts to get information from John. These names just kind of are so...
They're arbitrary.
Jan, Mike, John, Karen. Well, John Keller is an aristocrat. Aristocrat,
yes,
everybody. And he wants to not talk to her. Hold on, let me back up. John Keller is a reclusive aristocrat who was also there that night that Karen right. disappeared. But he refuses to speak to her, meaning Jane.
Yes.
Okay, so let me back up and clarify here. Because we're talking about age groups now. So Mrs. Aylward is old. This is Betty Davis. This character, she's in her 70s. It was like 20 years ago that her daughter Karen, with her friends, John and Mary and Tom, they had a seance. And something happened with a lightning storm and Karen disappeared.
Right.
Now, 20 years later, those other people, John, Mary, Tom, they are now old. They are now older
parent
people.
Age, basically.
Mm-hmm. Parent age. Exactly. So, yeah, I just wanted to clear that up.
Yeah, there's like three generations of people happening here. There's, Mrs. Aylward, who was the mother of the young girl, but then time goes back and forth. And so, yeah, we have now two kids, a set of parents, and a grandmother. Basically, who's not a grandmother because her child is gone.
Right. Okay. So, in a nutshell, Jan and Mike are trying to get info from the parents, from the adults, and they're not giving them anything. So, Jan is just like talking to whoever she can to try to figure out the mystery. She encounters a local hermit. This is Tom. And he's like, I was also there, but I also won't tell you anything. Except he does reveal that there was a seance-like ceremony during a lunar eclipse, and that's when Karen vanished. So now we have an eclipse plotline that comes into play. Yeah, I'll leave it there for now.
An eclipse and some sort of like an electrical storm, like a lightning storm suddenly happens as well, which kind of plays part into it a little bit here and there. And we've got, all these different tellings of what happened that night, and we're not sure which one is accurate or not, or if any of them are accurate, or if something more nefarious is happening. It's very unclear. Purposefully, I hope. Okay, so so Jan hears, she latches onto the story of the seance, because that to her seems the most likely scenario is that clearly witchcraft was involved in this, and so let's recreate it. So she decides to recreate this ceremony during an upcoming solar eclipse that is a day or so away, hoping that it's going to be the mystery that will maybe bring Karen back. She's decided that Karen is still out there somewhere and that maybe we just need to bring her back. She's stuck somewhere, perhaps. So she gathers these three adults, Mary, Tom, and John, at the abandoned chapel, and they attempt to repeat this same ceremony that happened many years ago. Meanwhile, Ellie, Jan's younger sister, while watching the eclipse from the front yard, suddenly goes into this weird trance-like state. Apparently, she's possessed, basically, and she enters into the woods, basically hypnotized, kind of being forced to walk into the woods. At the chapel, the ceremony is interrupted by a powerful wind that shatters the windows, and Ellie disappears. In a voice that is not her own, she explains that an accidental switch took place 30 years ago, in which Karen traded places, here's where we go wild, with an alien presence from an alternate dimension. Thus, the Watcher has been haunting the woods since that day, while Karen has remained suspended in time. Yeah, this is I feel like you and I both went, wait, what?
Yep. And here's how it ends. This is the theatrical version. The ultimate theatrical version, because we'll get into it later. But the Watcher leaves Ellie's body and manifests as a pillar of light, fueled by the circle of friendship, because everyone is circled around with their hands together chanting. The light engulfs Jan and lifts her into the air, and like, it's going to happen, we're going to have success, but then good old boy Mike shows up and pulls her away. He like throws everything off, but in good family movie fashion, it's manufactured suspense, because ultimately everything does happen well for folks. Things turn out well. The eclipse ends. Karen is the same age as she disappeared. She now reappears, still blindfolded. And she takes off her blindfold, and she meets her mom again after 30 years. And it's very sweet. And then credits roll.
Yeah, it just sort of ends very softly like that. With everyone's just like, okay, I guess that happened. We're cool with it. Moving on.
Yep. So this is, so listeners, Patrick and I watched this together, and we had the same kind of muted response. We were like, okay,
sure.
Okay. And I'm going through the bonus features on the Blu-ray, and I see that there are some deleted scenes. I'm like, oh, hey, let's watch some deleted scenes so we can be good podcasters and do this thing. And I expected nothing, just like some B-roll, right? Like nothing impressive. We were treated to the alternate endings of this movie. And that beam of light that you get when you watch it, that beam of light is replaced with a full-on puppet animatronic monster. It's an alien that shows up from another dimension, and it has mandibles, and it's drooling, and it's very frightening. And that is what happens. I mean, everything else kind of falls into line, but instead of a pretty harmless, boring old light, we get an actual creature brought to life on the screen.
I wish that they had kept it. But I also understand, though, they just hadn't been building up to that kind of an ending for this movie, so it didn't make any. It made even less sense than the movie that they ended up going with. So yeah, but I will say it was impressive, the creature that they created. Because I looked it up and I was like, did ILM do that? Who did this? And they just sort of shoestringed it together. Like somebody in their art department sort of built this character. It sort of looks like early renderings of Alien from Alien and sort of like, what are they called? The Skeksis from The Dark Crystal, if you remember those characters. It kind of looked like a amalgamation of those two. It was pretty impressive. And it was interesting that the alien, though looking terrifying, right, it spoke to them and told them. The alien told them the story of what happened, of like, Karen got trapped. We didn't mean to take her, but she's stuck, and I'm stuck here, and we need to switch places so all can be right with the world. And it sort of gave a little bit more resolve, I think, to the end of the story, which I didn't quite get from the ending that they went with, ultimately. So I don't know who made that decision, but it was not me. It wouldn't have been me.
Right. Right. It was not you. You were not alive at the time.
Okay. What did you think of it? Did it? I mean, what was your preference? The original ending, or the ending, the ending they went with, or this ending with the alien in it?
Oh, with the alien. And it's because, like, it may not make sense. Like you say, I agree. Like, this movie's not building up to a full-blown creature effect. But you know what? It's memorable. It's going to get me talking more about it.
Yeah.
It's going to, like, it's exciting. I don't care if it doesn't make sense, because the rest of the movie is solid, but it's not leaving a lasting impression the way this ending would.
And it's more in line with the book. So the book does deal with another world, another planet, an alien sort of body snatching kind of a thing, accidental trading of an alien for a human. And so it makes a lot more sense to the book, but because they refused to follow the book up until now, it didn't make sense then in the movie. It was like, wait, what? This never was a plot line in the movie, but it was the only plot line in the book. So I don't know why they changed so much. It didn't hold up, I don't think, as much as it could have.
Yeah. Then there was a third alternate ending, which was kind of a blend of both. So you still got the alien, but now there's a whole sequence where the movie takes us to the alien world. And it's like a trippy astral plane, just like in time and space. And we see Karen in the void on this alien's home world. Well, I thought that was that I was like, that this is really out there. Like, I love it so much.
It was cool.
But this is where me as a director or a producer would go, eh, we can cut that much.
And I think part of the reason why that didn't make it either is that they just didn't finish it in time. I think that was the ending that they were trying to go for, but because they were pushing this movie to come out in such a weird timeline, like they, for some reason, they wanted it to come out at a specific time, they didn't finish editing it and creating that in time, and so they ditched it and went with the different ending. So, very strange.
Wow.
Very, very strange.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, honestly, if you're going to watch this movie, everybody, make sure you also give time to the alternate
endings. Yeah, if you have it available somewhere, if you can find a copy of it somewhere that has the alternate endings, definitely give those a watch. It is fascinating to see the journey that this movie went on.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you for bearing with our synopsis there.
We did our best.
We did our best. We blindfolded doing our best there. Just some quick background, some things we hadn't mentioned before. Is there anything in here that we haven't mentioned? Okay, so the movie is ultimately premiered in New York City in April of 1980. It ran for one dismal week. Like, nobody was buying tickets to see this movie. Disney decided it'd be better to pull it and just order rewrites and edits. So after April 1980, this movie disappears until October 81. And that's when it gets its wide release. So, yes, it's technically a 1980 movie, but this movie is, for all intents and purposes, even later than that, 1981.
Yeah, they...
Which I find so interesting.
Well, I think part of it, there was an actor strike that was happening. And so that delayed the reshoots a ton. And so this movie just had too much going on for it to have ever made successful sense, because there were so many writers, so many changes happening. They pulled it, they brought it back, the strike happened. It suffered from really just bad timing. And I think too many cooks in the kitchen, I feel like.
Yeah. I find it so interesting when a movie's release is pushed back so far after it was finished shooting. Like, this movie filmed in 1979, and now it's not being released until the end of 1981. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, do sensibilities change in audiences? Does fashion change?
Sure.
Like, what people are interested in 1979... Yeah. By almost 1982, it's like...
And interesting, by this time, Friday the 13th would have been released then. A full, enormous horror movie was released in between when it was supposed to be released and when this one was... Yeah, it's just, a lot did change.
I think the second one had been was released
actually, yeah.
And the Halloween movies, too. Halloween 2 was... So,
it may have suffered because...
Like, it's Friday night... It's Friday night. You're in high school. You're going to the movies with your buddies. Obviously, you want to go see a horror movie. What do you have? Jason to pick from? Michael Myers. Oh, what about this Disney movie? Oh, is there a slasher in it?
Right.
No.
It's got Betty Davis. Because it's Halloween time when they did finally release it. Yeah, during the time frame that these huge horror movies were coming out, this was no longer a horror movie. And so,
No self-respecting, horror-loving teenager is going to choose this over an actual scary movie.
So, and that reflected then in the box office, because it made only $5 million, like total, from soup to nuts. It made $5 million, but it was made for roughly $9 million. So it lost millions and millions of dollars. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
This movie was cursed from day one, it seems.
Like, Disney, I appreciate the effort, but clearly it's not your wheelhouse, right?
But, I mean, somehow it did then turn into a cult classic. It is listed as a cult classic, which I mean there's no like one person who gets to decide that, but I think it, you know, by whatever the the beings that are that make it so, it is definitely revered as a cult classic, even though you can't really find it anywhere.
Yeah. So. I have my three questions with three, it's multiple choice. I have them pulled up on a separate document, so you cannot see them, but I'm going to read them to you, okay? And you're going to do the same to me, and we're going to see who comes out on top.
No one does with this movie. I'm just kidding. No, here we go.
Okay, go for it.
Are you ready? Okay, your first question, Vincent. So in 1981, which is interesting that this song came out before the wide release of The Watcher in the Woods, but was not intended to do so. But in 1981, the song Betty Davis Eyes hits the charts, and it was number one for 9 weeks in a row. Who performed this song, Vincent? Was it? Was it Blondie? Was it Kim Carnes? Or was it Pat Benatar?
Oh, I've heard of this song.
It's a great song.
How does
it
go?
She's got Betty Davis eyes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You know she's still alive? Betty Davis eyes was performed by a Blondie.
That is not correct. Many people think it was Blondie because she sounds a lot like her, but it was Kim Carnes.
All right, there you go.
I think it was maybe her only big hit was Betty Davis Eyes.
Ah, yeah. All right. All right. 1 point for
Patrick. Or is this 0 points for anybody because you didn't get it? Do I get a point for you getting it wrong? Okay.
No,
I was
right.
I'll take it. But
sorry.
Yes.
All right, Patrick. Great. Here's your question. Several locations in The Watcher in the Woods are the same used as in this other ghost movie. Is it The Others from 2001? The Haunting from 1963?
Okay.
Or The Uninvited from 1944.
Oh, gosh. I'd have to figure out. Are all of these movies... Can I ask a follow-up question? Because I'm trying to figure out which... I feel like... Was the Haunting... Was that about Hill House? Was that the same storyline as The Haunting of Hill House? Or is it a different movie altogether that I'm thinking of? Or do you know?
I believe it's a different movie.
Well, then maybe it's not that one. But I don't think The Others was filmed there. That was Nicole Kidman, right? The Others?
Yeah.
I thought that was filmed here. And what was the other one? The Other? No, not The Others. The Haunting and...
It's called The Uninvited.
I like that title. But I don't know the movie. I'm gonna go with my gut instinct told me The Haunting. So I'm just going to stay. I'm going to stay there. Is it The Haunting?
It is The Haunting.
I have no basis for why I think that was it, so I'll take the point, but I did not logically sound it out. So
yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty cool connection. The director of Watcher in the Woods did that intentionally. Oh. So like the old manor house is the same one in England they used for The Haunting, which is by Shirley Jackson, who also wrote The Haunting.
That's funny.
It's related. The Uninvited is one of my favorite movies. It's the first ghost movie to take the ghosts, to depict real ghosts.
Wait, what?
Meaning, before 1944, if there was a ghost in a movie, by the end of that movie, it turned out it was all just somebody in a mask.
Okay, got it. Interesting.
Yep. So The Uninvited, like, no, this is an actual haunted house. It's very spooky.
Oh,
it's a thriller.
That's good to know. It's the first movie that supposes that ghosts are real, is basically what you're saying at the end of it. By the end of the movie, ghosts exist in this realm. Interesting.
Yeah, or at least gets credit for it.
All right, I'll have to look that up. Good to know. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, oh, well, I have an accidental point there. All right. All right, which of these movies, Vincent, does not contain an alien character or plot line in Disney history? Which of these movies that may sound like they do does not actually have an alien plot line or a character in the movie? Is it Escape to Witch Mountain? Is it Night Crossing? Or is it Flight of the Navigator?
Could I have a repeat of that question, please?
The full question. Which of these Disney movies does not contain an alien character or plot line? So no alien, no sci-fi plot line. Escape to Witch Mountain, Night Crossing, or Flight of the Navigator?
Flight of the Navigator, Night Crossing, or the Witch Mountain. I haven't seen any of these.
You should. They're all great movies.
Oh. I will. Let me just go off the cuff and say Flight of the Navigator. Because maybe it's about a pirate. Oh,
that flies.
Or it's like, just tell me, what is it?
I'm sorry to tell you, it is not Flight of the Navigator. Flight of the Navigator is full of aliens.
Damn it. Chock
full of aliens. And it's a wonder.
E.T. is out the butt. Just
booming with aliens. And that's a wonderful, movie.
Wow.
The answer is Night Crossing does not have an alien plotline. Night Crossing has a hot air balloon instead, of which people are escaping from East Germany to West Germany in a hot air balloon. And it's a real story. It's a true story as well. Yeah.
Wow. So that's what I was thinking. Like, we're going to have a Flight of the Navigator. You know, to me, it sounds like an animated movie about geese flying south through the winter. I don't know.
I'm sorry about that. You should watch Flight of the Navigator, though. It's very cute. Okay. It's very fun. A young Sarah Jessica Parker is in Flight of the Navigator. I think it was her first movie ever. Yeah.
Wow. There it is. Flight of the Navigator. Yeah. A boy mysteriously gains knowledge of the farthest reaches of the universe.
Hey, points for not cheating, though. You could have looked it up and I wouldn't have known. So, well done to you.
I could have. Maybe I'll watch The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes. Another great title.
All right.
Okay. All right. 1-0. You're leading here.
Yeah.
So, upon its release of The Watcher in the Woods, critic Michael Blowen of the Boston Globe was unimpressed. And he said, quote, "Everything in the film, direction, acting, writing, music arrangements, and editing, is as transparent as... ... fill in the blank is as transparent as which of these fictional ghosts? Is it the Headless Horseman, the ghost of Hamlet's dad, or Casper the friend or Casper the friendly ghost?"
Okay. I'm gonna narrow this down, because I don't believe the Headless Horseman is transparent. I think that he was like I'm trying to be logical here, so that's maybe not so much that one. Casper, an interesting reference. I believe that character was created in the 50s, so this could have been Casper, or the ghost of Hamlet's dad. Is that what the other one was?
You know, the ghost of Hamlet's dad was also created long before
but was more of an apparition, I feel like. So I'm going to go.
I'm going to go
with Casper. Casper the friendly ghost.
You are the friendly podcaster who have got. Hey! You have another point.
See what happens when you do. You got to use your brain sometimes to narrow it down. And I.
Well, the Headless Horseman's head is transparent.
There it is. Yeah, that is true. You can see through that pumpkin if it's carved. Okay, here we go. What a quote too. Oof, that's a rough one. You don't come back from that easily. It's a movie from someone who compares you to Casper the Friendly Ghost. Yikes. Okay.
Yeah.
So the character Jan, who was played by Lynn Holly Johnson, who was nominated for a Golden Globe and won a Razzie Award. Quite the spectrum there. Was not the original woman cast in this role for The Watcher in the Woods. Another up-and-coming young actress was originally cast. Who was that actress? Was it Holly Hunter? Was it Diane Lane? Or was it Jodie Foster?
Jodie Foster rears her head again, but it is not. It is
Diane
Lane.
Oh, you know the answer
Lane.
To this one. Diane Lane is correct.
Oh,
you did
yeah.
research. Okay. Ding, 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 ding. What? Good. Good on you. It pays to read.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. I try to read.
Here and there. It happens. It happens. What a different career she may have had if she had been in Watcher in the Woods.
What a different movie.
I'm trying to figure out,
because
when did The Outsiders come out? That was that well before this movie? When was that? Was that in the 70s or was that later?
I think it was later in the 80s.
Okay. Because she would have been very young then if she was originally cast in this role. And then she...
It was 1983.
Right. And then she dropped it. I can't remember what movie she got, but she dropped this movie and they ended up casting Lynn Holly Johnson instead.
Well, so you are winning 2-1. So you could go for the sweep here.
Okay. Going for the, what is it called? The hat trick? Is that when you score three? Okay.
Yep. The hat trick.
Patrick the hat trick.
For the Narek Award for winning the trivia goes to, but let's see what you can do with this third one. This was the highest grossing movie of 1981, which incidentally also features ghosts. Was it A, Poltergeist, B, Raiders of the Lost Ark, or C, Superman 2?
Oh, boy. Highest grossing movie of the year. I'm so bad with dates and when movies came out. I'm going to go with, for some reason, Raiders of the Lost Ark stuck out to me, but I don't know if that's true.
Ding, ding, ding.
Full guess.
That's
full
it.
On guess there. I had no actual knowledge of that, but okay, great. Amazing.
You are too humble.
No, it's true. I did not know that. I totally guessed that.
Well, that's all right. You know, it's all for fun. The points don't matter. I'll just come at you next time.
I'm basing the full outlook of how this week goes based on how I score in these games. So it does matter. It matters to me.
Well, you have 9 points total.
Hey.
And I have 7.5.
You know what? From four episodes, you were pretty close in score here. It's not as though one of us is sweeping the games.
No, you're right. It's all neck and neck because I have a running tally here and we've essentially been tied actually since the very beginning.
Yeah, we've been basically trading a point here or there back and forth per episode. So,
yeah. Fantastic.
Well done, everybody. Well done.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Well done. We did it.
No, it's fun. It's a fun movie full of trivia that I honestly love talking about.
Yeah.
And I love the genre. So
it's a good genre.
Like,
it's
supernatural.
It's a good it's a booming like time in history as well for movies like this. So it was fun to investigate.
Yeah.
If nothing else.
It's a good movie for spooky season. Let me just say that if this is currently September or October that we're dropping this episode, friends, listeners, We hope you can seek this movie out or watch some of the other movies we talked about, some of the other spooky ghost movies.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think. But Patrick, do you have any final thoughts?
Final thoughts. You know, I didn't dislike this movie. Is it a movie that would have necessarily, if it were available on Disney Plus, would I watch it a lot? Probably not. But it is definitely, I think what is great about this movie for nerds like us is that the historical context behind it and like all the things that happened before and after and because of this movie is what's interesting to me about this movie. And I'd also say if you have the chance, check out the book. It's a pretty decent book, and it does have a more fleshed out plot line that you can follow. That's a little bit more easier to grasp onto, and it's pretty well written. So I recommend the book as well. I can lend it to you next if you want to read it.
Sure. Yeah. I think this as a monster movie, you know, doesn't have a quote unquote monster. The alternate endings do. As a whole, again, it makes me want to watch other ghost movies that I do find more compelling. Watcher in the Woods is solid enough. Good gateway horror. Mm-hmm. There's a link to, I'll drop a link to a blog from the British Film Institute that talks about it in that aspect as just gateway horror.
Sure.
So for young folks listening out there, if you don't like horror movies, you'll find this one a little more digestible.
Yeah.
So I think there's value in that, too.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love that. Love that.
All right.
Well, do you want to know?
Yes.
I was going to say, do you want to know what's up next for us on Magic and Monsters?
I'm dying to know. This is my Disney fix. Like, you got to tell me what to watch.
All right. So with my reveal of what movie we're watching next, you actually, I think, may have a choice on this. And you don't have to decide now. We can decide later as well. In which version of this movie we watch. So,
Ooh.
We're staying on trend here with something that's hot in cinema these days, and that is the theme of dragons. And so, with our next movie, we are going to watch Pete's Dragon. A movie I love.
Cool.
So there is an original Pete's Dragon, which has more of an animated dragon and is a musical as well. Or there is a remake of Pete's Dragon that is more CGI and a non-musical version of the movie. So I can let you decide, or we can debate it later on, and we don't have to decide now which one we end up watching for Magic and Monsters.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to watch both.
Yes, I recommend. Sure. I think both are definitely worth a watch for sure. But they are pretty different movies though as well. So
totally reflective, I think, of the decades they were made in. Just looking at the images,
absolutely, and maybe, yeah, and maybe we can find a way to watch both and definitely maybe dissect both and their differences.
That's such a fun choice. I can't wait. Pete's Dragon. 1970s or the 2010s. Amazing. Folks, we'll be confirming which title later. But let me just do a quick plug for Camp Kaiju stuff, mm-hmm. and then you can do the same and we'll head out.
Yeah.
But friends, thank you for listening to Magic and Monsters, brought to you by Gaze Do the D and Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. You can follow my dear podcast at campkaijupodcast.com, on Instagram at camp_kaiju_podcast, or just follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a positive rating and review if you like what you hear. Let us know what you want to hear more of. We cover traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. And me and my co-host Matt Levine really dive into not just the production history of these films, but also our personal reviews. And we love what we do, and we love talking about these movies and sharing them with folks. So thank you for listening. Hope to see you around on the airwaves. Hear you around.
I love that. I hope to hear you around. I like that. I guess that means it's my turn. So yeah, I've been Patrick Kazuki from Gaze Do the D podcast, a Disney themed podcast where we talk about all things Disney, movies, parks, what's hot in the news, with a little bit of an LGBTQ+ perspective around it. There are four podcast hosts, myself, Ryan, Kale, and JT, and we drop episodes every 2 weeks. So look for us on Instagram at GDTD Podcast, or we are on online. Our website is gaze2thed.com, or you can, if you have any questions, drop us an email at info@gaze2thed.com. And a quick thank you to Patreon listeners on both sides, on Camp Kaiju and on Gaze to the D. We thank you for your support, which keeps the lights on to do projects like this.
And a personal shout out to our patrons over at Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast: Jason, Beast Drool, Chris B, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. Thank you so much. Patrick and crossover fans, if you are interested in any of this information, we will drop all these links and more into the show notes.
Absolutely. And don't forget to hit that like button. I always forget to say that. Hit the like button. It does help us out a lot. So even if you didn't like it, hit it. So maybe your enemies will find us. Yeah.
All right. Until next time, stay campy.
She's got Betty Davis eyes.